Hi, bienvenidos. This is a special presentation collaboration of Barnstorming PA and SEIU Healthcare's CaresEssential.org. En un momento, oirá un pequeño introducción en español por Mari López Rasquez. So, I just want to let Spanish speakers know that there's going to be a brief overview of what the key event is, if you want to listen to that. For all of our other listeners, what you're going to hear after our normal introduction and the Spanish from Maddie is a great conversation that I had with Lynn Widener, Maddie López-Rasquez, Kearney Warren, Erica Payne, Lenoral Thomas. This was put together through the hard work of Dwayne Heiser and Hillary Rothrock and others. It's really a great podcast that dives into the stories of people's lives and also what kinds of policies we need to see take place. July 13th is a very important focusing day of action, but it's not the end of the campaign. Please go to careisessential.org, all one word, to see how you can get involved and help. Barnstorming PA. This is a special episode with an amazing panel of healthcare workers, and I believe you're all union members. Is that correct?
Yes, we are.
That's great. So I'm just going to ask you all to popcorn around. I'll start with Kearney, and if I mispronounce a name, please correct me. I know that guy, Dwayne, is that his name? How do you say it? Oh, Dwayne. He put us all together. Just say your name, where you're from, your role in healthcare, and, you know, some kind of fun fact about yourself. So, I'll go first. My name is Jordy. I live in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Fun healthcare fact is I've had knee operations. I've had about five knee operations, and I'm only 48. So I don't know if that's fun. And I'm going to popcorn over to Kearney. So Kearney, say hi and then just throw it to somebody else. Okay.
Hello, I'm Kearney Warren. I am a home care worker in Chester. I'm also running for my local city council. And a fun healthcare fact about me is that I was recently on the COVID-19 Racial Task Equity Committee, subcommittee for COVID-19. I was recently on the COVID-19 Racial Equity Task Force subcommittee for the Governor Wolf's administration.
Awesome. Did that come before you decided to run for office, or what was?
It did. It came, actually, the opportunity came to me when myself and three other home care workers, including Erica, we're in Pittsburgh fasting for 15.
Okay. I've interviewed Hillary. She was with you too, right?
Yes.
Oh, she was great. Okay. So will you throw it to somebody else then?
Sure. And I will popcorn it to Lynn.
Hello. My name is Lynn, and I am a home care worker in the Lehigh Valley. And I don't know. Fun fact. I've been.
Could be any fun fact about yourself. It doesn't have to be just a.
Oh my gosh. See, now you've broadened it and really confused me.
Oh, okay. That's my job. I was a professor too. So that's kind of that's my thing.
There you go. I got my CNA license in 2003 and I've worked in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, group homes, and now I work in home care. And I've lived in two states, North Carolina and Pennsylvania. I lived in Charlotte for 10 years. And that is a whole other story and how I got there.
That's awesome.
I've lived many lives in my life.
Yeah, I hear that. So, you know, I used to live in the Lehigh Valley and I was always in the impression that, you know, generally that's kind of like that's not a regional identity that sticks a lot, right? Like usually you're really from Nazareth or Emmaus or Bethlehem. So are you from like a place in the Lehigh Valley?
I always say the Lehigh Valley because I was born in Bethlehem. I went to school in Hellertown, which nobody knows.
I know.
Hellertown, fun fact, off of I-78. Off I-78, it's mile marker 66.6 to Hellertown. I always thought that was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of wedged in between the old steel factories and the interstate, Hellertown.
I live in Allentown.
You live in Allentown.
Yeah. Hey,
we're going to get that energy back. Will you toss it to one of your three colleagues, please?
Sure. Erica, why don't you go up next?
Hi, my name's Erica, and I'm living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And a fun healthcare fact.
Or any fact.
No. I focused on the healthcare, so I'm right in there. I'm in that zone. Okay. For 3 years, I have been treating myself for upper back issues and then found out, I think February of this year, that I don't have upper back issues. I have carpal tunnel in both hands and it's dormant in the wrist. How much fun is that? So I don't even know until I start losing like strength and I have a lot of pain in my arms and in my back. That is bothering me.
So the dormant thing means that like you're not feeling it in your wrists. So the problems kind of migrate up. Is that
right? I thought it was coming down, but really it was coming up the entire time.
Right. Yeah. The body is a crazy system, right? Of like feedback loops and that's my like layperson's understanding. All right. Will you toss it to one of our other two guests?
Sure. I'll throw it over to Lenoral.
Thanks, Erica. My name is Lenoral Thomas. I work for SEIU in the healthcare division and have the honor of leading our long-term care campaign. A fun fact about me, one reason that home care workers are near and dear to my heart is that I am the granddaughter of a home care worker.
That's wonderful. I need just a little bit of educating. So I hear home health care and home care. Are those interchangeable? Does that mean the same thing?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. And Lenora, will you throw it to Maddie, please?
Absolutely. Madeline?
Hi, everyone. I'm Madeline Lopez-Vasquez. And fun fact about me, I've been in healthcare since the age of 19, so about 30-something years without revealing my age. And I just happened to stumble into it. I was with my sister, who was having her firstborn, and I went with her to a doctor's appointment, and I saw healthcare. I fell in love with the way people needed to be treated and how everyone was so gentle and everyone loving. And I said, you know what? There's no price on this, and this is what I want to really do. You know, I was 20 years old working in Wall Street, making money, but I wasn't happy. So I applied to healthcare, and here I am. Since then, I've been also a delegate, always voicing my opinion. Really, you couldn't shut me up if you tried. And now I'm president of my chapter, an NPO member, and part of the women's leadership also in the union. And I'm very proud to be in healthcare. I'm in the hospital sector.
Awesome. So just to recap, we've got five amazing, hardworking women who are both healthcare workers and leaders. Kearney, Lynn, Erica, and Maddie, you're all in Pennsylvania. Lenoral, you work nationally. Is that correct?
That is correct. I live in Northern Virginia, but I am an original Georgia peach. I'm from Savannah, Georgia.
Ah, all right. Yes, I know Northern Virginia. My wife is from Fairfax County. I got married in Fairfax. That's my last. I don't really have Georgia connections. Although I do have some really profound questions about Stone Mountain. Like, I'm just kind of like, can we like talk about the biggest, ugliest Confederate monument? but that's another podcast. So I'm kind of guessing that in terms of women and racial diversity, this is a pretty representative group of folks from your industry. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Home care workers are 87% women, overwhelmingly women of color. But it, you know, it's a very diverse workforce as it relates to women.
Awesome. So one of the main things we want to talk about is this campaign that is July 13th, the launch point, Lenoral, is that, or the sort of big event?
July 13th is actually a crescendo in a lot of activity that has been happening over the last year and a half.
Okay. So what we want to do now is, let's kind of preview that. So maybe in a sec, somebody can talk about what's happening July 13th. And then we're going to go back a little bit and set the table, like why, you know, what are the needs and get into that. And then we can revisit July 13th and what's happening that day. Does that make sense? So who can kind of sort of do the, who's the pitch person? Who's the salesperson? This is what July 13th is.
That would be me, Jordy.
Go for it.
Okay. So July 13th, workers across the country are joining together for a day of disruptive action for a Care is Essential day of action to fight for jobs, care, and justice, and to say enough is enough. There'll be large marches in D.C., Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, other cities, plus there'll be block parties, sit-ins, marches, car caravans for care workers and the people that they care for. We are going to D.C. With a clear demand for Congress to respect us, protect us, and pay us by passing the jobs plan for $400 billion to be invested in care jobs. And home care workers and SEIU members are leading the way. We'll be joined by allies from the National Domestic Workers Alliance, people from the Fight for 15, and a union, our racial immigrants, and along with our climate justice partners, other labor organizations, and other community partners and allies.
Oh, that was fantastic. I love it. So let me just tease out one thing, because I know I get confused. So the American Rescue Package was like the first big response to the pandemic that came out of Congress that the Biden administration supported. I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong, the American Jobs Plan?
Yes. So the American Jobs Plan specifically has $400 billion set aside for home and community-based services, specifically for caregivers. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in detail once we go over that.
So, no, that's great. I'm glad you said that. And so care is essential. Can somebody maybe like talk about like why that phrase and, you know, what we're trying to communicate to the, either to Congress or the broader public? I mean, I realize it's sort of self-evident, but I'm just kind of, Lenora, go ahead.
So Care is Essential came about because at the start of the pandemic, as we know, healthcare workers were literally on the front lines and have continued to be. And everyone talked about how essential these workers were, but at the same time, they were not treated as essential workers. And so the more we talked about it, the more workers stood up and demanded what they needed to protect themselves, their families, their consumers. It just came about that care is essential and that at this time, in this moment, we were battling several pandemics. So there was the actual COVID-19 pandemic. economic, racial, all of these different things happening. And so home care workers, long-term care workers, so nursing home workers just stood up and said, enough is enough. Care is essential. And we must take this moment to fix a system that has been broken for centuries. The systemic racism, sexism that long-term care was built upon, it's time to dismantle that. And this is an opportunity to do it.
Oh, so true. Yeah, I think about the pandemic in my head, and I've played with this a little bit. It was like a scouring, right? Everything was scoured, and then it revealed all of these ways in which critical infrastructures have been neglected. You know, it just popped into my head that the horrible tragedy in Miami, which was a building infrastructure. We have all these human infrastructures and systemic infrastructures that have been neglected, and even, I mean, you mentioned sexism, Lenore. I mean, I'll just say this, and, you know, if I go too far, you'll pull me back. But like, patriarchy is sort of front and center in this, because it seems to me for generations and generations, the assumption was that people who needed help, whether they were had a physical disability, or they were ill for a long term, or they were older, someone in the house is going to take care of that. Mm-hmm. Right. And then later we started paying a little bit for that, but, you know, it was never really defined as a career, right? Does that sort of seem like an accurate description? Yeah. Anybody jump in?
Can I speak to that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I'm sorry. So
Kearney, then Maddie.
Okay. So you're exactly right, Jordy. And what I would like to add to that is that the domestic work, including care work, they both were left out of the early labor laws because the workers were primarily women, and disproportionately women of color. Mm-hmm. And our work has had horrible stigmas attached to it. Many people look down upon caregivers because they have never had the honor of caring for someone who was unable to completely care for themselves. And unless you care for someone, you don't know the level of skill, the amount of mental and physical strength and stamina that's required to keep the people you are caring for alive. And so when we talk about infrastructure, care work makes other work outside of the home possible. So if it wasn't for caregivers, other people would not be able to enjoy the luxury of their careers, because they would have to stay home with their families. But we as caregivers, we do that work to allow other people to go outside of the home and work. So we are actually contributing to the economy. Right now, there's over 180,000 families who are waiting for home-based and community services. But because home care workers are paid poverty wages, there just aren't a lot of home care workers available to take that position. And 2 out of 5 home care workers leave their jobs annually because of the lack of benefits and poverty wages.
I'm so glad you said that, Kearney. And for sure, for many people, that career is a luxury. I know sometimes also for me, like, having a good surgeon who could take my gallbladder out was not really a luxury. So sometimes it's even essential things. Maddie, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, I want to join my sisters here in saying the truth. As a Latina woman, and I think it's important that the society sees that it's not just the woman's place to stay home and take care of everyone. And it has been expected in a lot of Latino communities to have that. But we are care essential workers in hospitals and everywhere. And we are so essential and so determined. I mean, we're the CEO of the family, to tell you the truth. Okay, so the family breaks or makes, however the woman is strong. And we know this, all right? I mean, every man is the head of the family, but the backbone is the woman. And that's the truth. But, you know, and what I'm trying to say is, nosotros tenemos que unirnos y seguir peleando esa pelea. Es una pelea muy importante. Es muy importante que la mujer sea esencial en ocupar el supuesto, en ganar su puesto y ganar muy buen dinero. Ahora mismo ganamos muy poco dinero. No hay suficiente empleados para tratar a nuestros pacientes o a nuestros ancianos en su casa. es un placer estar en su casa cuando uno está enfermo. Y deben de uno apreciar a la gente, a todo el mundo que va a cuidar a esa gente. Es muy importante respetar, honorar y pagarle a esa gente su valor. Gracias.
No, de acuerdo, Madeline. Y no sé si Duane te dijo, pero hablo español también. Mi padre es un inmigrante de España. Y al final quiero que, bueno, primero quiero que entres cuando quisieras para poner algún parte en español cristiano. Y también al final, quizás tú y yo recordamos, por ejemplo, un pequeño anuncio sobre las acciones del 13 de julio. Y puedo cortarlo y ponerlo al principio para los hispanohablantes que escuchen, que pueden oír esta parte tan importante al principio. ¿De acuerdo?
De acuerdo, sería mi placer. Gracias.
Sí, y también yo sé que tengo un acento fortísimo norteamericano. Siempre en España me molestan de esto, pero voy adelante como puedo.
Don't worry, you're good. I speak Spanish, English, and Spanglish.
Yeah, any other Spanish speakers in our crew? I also speak Catalan, which is Jordi. My name is Catalan. My father's from Barcelona, where they speak Spanish and Catalan. So Jordi is Jorge in Spanish. It's Jordi in Catalan. It's George in English. But anyway. I was really curious, Eric or Lynn, we haven't heard much from you, but when Kearney was talking about so many important things, the honor of working for caring for somebody, how important, you know, Kearney, I was thinking about a bridge brings your body to work and a home healthcare worker keeps grandma safe. You know, like you need like to be able to do my job, the person's job, like you need to get there and you need to know that other things are taken care of. So from the perspective of essentiality, right? I think that's kind of what you were getting at. But Lynn or Eric or Maddie or anybody, you know, do you want to share some stories about any of the things we've touched on?
Well, I know that also we talk about a lot of family caregivers. So a lot of people talk about they're taking care of their family. It's just not true that everybody who is in home care is just taking care of a family member. We also take care of other people's family members. So I've worked in the nursing homes and used the Hoyer lifts and all of the skills that I use.
What's a Hoyer lift?
A Hoyer lift is a mechanical lift. It's like you use a sling, you put it underneath a person, and you can like lift them and move them around into a wheelchair or to bed. And we use the Hoyer lifts. I use them in home care as well. So this is like a mechanical thing. This is a skill that we also use in the home setting. And not only are we taking care of, you know, elderly people, we also have a huge responsibility in home care towards people with disabilities. And home and community-based services are essential for these people to be able to get up and get to work, to be a part of their communities, an active part of their communities. My consumer is actually my roommate. And without home care services, he would be in a facility. He would not be able to have a life in the community. And this is the case for a lot of people who contribute, who work, who can't get out of bed without their caregivers. So when we're talking about care, we're not just talking about, you know, somebody taking care of grandma so I can go to work. We're also talking about people who work and need this assistance to get up and get active in their communities. And I think that's really important, too, because we talk about, you know, home care, we're essential, but we're essential because of the people that we care for. And I always like to lift them up first because they're the reason that we do this, you know. And I don't know. Traditionally, people, especially people with disabilities, have been left out of the conversation a lot of times. And the fact that there are so many people with disabilities waiting for services is absolutely disgusting. I know somebody with a disability who has been waiting 3 years for a shower. And that is because there's not enough funding for home and community-based services that would allow her the quality of life to even get a shower or the equipment that she needs. It's just that we in our society, we don't value people with disabilities and the elderly and the sick and the people who take care of them as much as we value other things. So I mean, it's frustrating.
For sure, for sure. I'm going to get to you, Erica, but Lynn, I'm wondering, what's the story? Like, did you have a calling in terms of your roommate? Was that somebody you already knew that needed help, or do you mind sharing that? You don't have to, but just.
I don't know. It's fine. And I've talked to him many times, and he's also an advocate for people with disabilities, and he's mm-hmm. on, speaks a lot. So he doesn't mind if I share his story a little bit. I met him when I was living in North Carolina. And he was, unfortunately, he was receiving home and community-based services in North Carolina. His mom decided he needed some socialization and sent him to an adult daycare. Mm-hmm. And the reason that me and him started talking is because the adult daycare that he was put at was basically for people with dementia and memory care issues. And he was completely a wrong fit. He had a job coach and all kinds of things. Nobody could find him a job. I mean, they tried. Nobody wanted to hire him. That he couldn't afford to go to school, and he couldn't get enough subsidies to go to school. Mm-hmm. So he just ended up in this gray zone, right, where he's now receiving, you know, home and community-based services and SSI, which is assistance for disabled people that are unable to work. And he's in this adult daycare setting where he's doing nothing. And I met him there. I was working there at the time. And because he didn't fit into our normal consumer type, we had basically my boss put me one-on-one with him. And from our talking, you know, we got to know each other. I left the job a couple weeks later, and then me and him sort of hooked up, and we've been together for 10 years now. And I take care of him. I give him the opportunity to live in the community. And I mean, he was really honestly shut away. His parents didn't take him out. When I met him, he was 22, and he had never been to like Chili's, mm-hmm. to a restaurant, like mm-hmm. stuff like that. Yeah. Like he went out maybe once a year on vacation. It's just, he didn't have the opportunities because of his situation, because of being, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's really frustrating for me specifically to see that so many people with disabilities are put on the back burner like that. Mm-hmm. And there's no place for them. And he has friends who have degrees and can't get a job because mm-hmm. nobody wants to accommodate their reasonable accommodations.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And I love how you said gray zone. I've had people in my extended family with Alzheimer's dementia, and you know, just the way you said that, it brought back, you know, the memory. Like it would be really, really hard, you know, to spend all day with those people who have those issues. And, you know, like that's kind of a gray zone for him in terms of like, they don't, you know, they don't remember who they talk to and other things. Although the one place that my mother and my wife's grandmother was in, was an Alzheimer's care place, and they were fantastic. And they also took in a lot of pets, like rescue animals, many of whom were missing a limb or something. So it was this really kind of great, like island of misfit toys, you know, these animals that didn't have a good place somewhere else, but were like a great, great fit there. I want to hear from Erica, but I just want to sort of pull something out because we've talked about poverty and poverty wages. And, you know, Lynn, you're talking about this wait list. Like what is a home healthcare worker? Like, what are we talking about? What are they making in Pennsylvania? If any of you all want to talk about that.
So this is part of why we are pushing Congress to pass the Better Care, Better Jobs Act, which is a part of the American Jobs Plan. Most home care workers, particularly here in Pennsylvania, make under $12 an hour. In 2019, the average salary for a home care worker was about $17,900.
For a year.
Yeah.
Okay. You can't live on that. Sorry. Right?
No, you can't. And this is why we're fighting to pass this act, because nearly half of home care workers currently rely on some form of government assistance, even though many of us work in excess of 40 hours a week or multiple jobs because home health care just does not pay the bills. And then there are some home health care workers who are unpaid. So we are making poverty wages. We are working multiple jobs. Some of us can't work outside of the home because of the level of care that the people that we're caring for requires. And the turnover is high because of it, because of the low poverty wages. We don't get paid time off. We don't have health insurance. And we're not making sustainable wages.
Do most home, you said no health insurance. Do most home healthcare workers, do they not work for an employer that's required to provide health insurance?
So some home care workers work for agencies. We work for the direct care participant model, which means that we don't have a uniform uniform payment, standard of payment, because our employers are essentially the people that we
care. Yeah. And so actually, you know, when you said that, what it reminds me of a little bit is, and there, you know, sometimes people talk about the gig economy or the gigification. So that's kind of it, right? Like people in that model, correct me if I'm wrong, Kearney, but basically you're treated as contractors, like you're out there, you know, as a business, I'm putting that in air quotes, which means that all of those things like benefits and other things, is it like an extra, right? It's like an extra worry, an extra bureaucratic hurdle to deal with. Is that, did I get that right?
Yeah, it's sort of like that, but we're actually, the people that we care for are considered our employers,
mm-hmm.
right? So we don't have an agency to go to, or we don't have HR to report issues. So if we need equipment, if we need mileage reimbursement, gas, all of that comes from our pockets.
Right, exactly. And so I'm going to go a little maybe out in left field here, but it's like sometimes in America, in the American economy, there's this sort of like every person can be a business person. Every person can be their, you know, successful and all of that. And so what that ends up doing from my perspective is like, you know, it's trying to make each person like this autonomous, like as if they were a business. And look, for some people, that's great. But what that means is, and this is true in the tech sector, it's true in what you're describing, like more and more, because providing healthcare, other kinds of benefits is a burden for a lot of businesses. They would rather that model, right? So basically, I don't know if you've ever heard this term, but we privatize the risk. I'm sorry, we privatize the benefit and we socialize the risk, right? So the risk of having to deal with all of that is being pushed on all these individual people, right? But then the benefit is just going, in this case, the, you know, underpaying what we're paying means that the rest of the economy, you know, that's like a hidden cost. So that's what I was kind of going for. But
it's a little interesting than that, because, you know, the healthcare industry would rather have agencies
mm-hmm.
versus our model, because we take money and services, so they think, away from agencies who are making a lot of money on the backs of the people who need care. And a lot of that money is not going to the bedside. And so that's why we're also passing we're trying to pass this American jobs plan so that there can be more transparency within our industry.
No, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. That's a great point. You know, I can imagine that maybe, you know, like a network of direct providers, like you're talking about, like working together, who could set the terms of like, you know, we need this kind of, you know, we need this kind of central office support, right? Like phone calls and all that. We want, like, if you all could organize that yourselves for fees that you like, that would be a much better model for you than the agencies who are like all middlemen in an economy, right? They want to squeeze you and squeeze the other, and then they get the difference. Erica, you're laughing. Kearney, I'm sorry. We got to get Erica on. Yeah. Go ahead, Erica.
Sorry, you're just throwing the cat around.
Oh, yes.
Going for a minute.
Yes, throwing the cat around.
I have to appreciate both Lynn and Kearney for everything they had stated, specifically when it came to race and care and values. And really what it comes down to is the values between the American government or the whole of the American value system versus the value system of the family. And that's where, you know, the I guess they call it critical race theory, although I've never read or anything like that, so I have no idea, is it comes into effect, because then we really understand why our position is so overpopulated with people of color and specifically women of color. You know, as Madeline was, or I'm sorry, Maddie was stating that, you know, the woman is the backbone and CEO of the house. I come from a multiracial background, so I have both sides that, you know, it's not unusual for there to be three generations in a house or one generation taking care of another. That's just not an unusual thing. When my mother became sick in 2017, I'd been working full time, and I'd been working full time since I was 17, or yeah, since I graduated high school, so about 17, 18. So it came to a point of deciding whether or not I was going to stop working full time in order to take care of her, or I was going to continue to work full time and she would have to be placed in, you know, a more intensive care facility. And that obviously wasn't even an option, not in our family, not with my background. It just wasn't an option. It really wasn't an option for me to quit working full time. She really needed full time care. This is care that, you know, I don't get paid for. So I have to do gig work, just as you were mentioning, gig economy. And I ended up working as one of my part time jobs, working with a woman who was disabled as a teenager in an accident, and she's quadriplegic. And in her family, also immigrant, her mother was the one who was taking care of her and her father, who was a Korean War vet. She was in her 80s. And the only, I guess you could use the word stable caregiver in the situation was me. They knew that I would come 5 days a week to help take care of her. So that was really the only person that her mother could depend on to make sure that, you know, she was getting help. There were other caregivers, but at the time of the pandemic, a lot of those caregivers that were working for agencies jumped ship because they weren't getting the protection that they needed. The pay was terrible and they didn't want to get sick. So that left the burden of her mother to not just take care of her and her needs, but also her husband, but, you know, my client's father as well, who ended up having a stroke, I believe 7 or 8 years back. I don't really remember. And needs 24-hour care as well. At the end of last year, about fall of last year, she ended up passing. I mean, okay, so age was a problem, but we're looking.
Somehow you muted yourself.
You know, the stress of taking care of two high needs people on top of the stress of fighting, you know, case coordinators who were supposed to find help for her daughter and were unable to do so. Mainly because they weren't working during the lockdown. They didn't work. And then when they did, no one was there to actually cover those shifts that were so desperately needed. On top of, she wasn't even able to take care of herself because she didn't have the time to take care of herself. And all those compressed into, you know, too much stress for her body. On the other hand, my mother, had just gone into the hospital, maybe February, the end of February of 2020. And I know it was around the beginning of March when she was being discharged. Her doctor had asked her to actually go to a nursing home. She wanted to discharge her to a nursing home. And my mother vehemently denied. She wanted to go home. She was not having it. We weren't having it. It wasn't an option. And the doctor even told her, if you do not go to a nursing home, you will be back in this hospital in 3 days. My mother came home that night and
he was predicting that her health would deteriorate.
Oh yeah. She was pretty much in critical condition at the time. And she came home that night and she did not go into a hospital until the end of December. And even then she didn't even stay overnight. So when we knew that she was coming home, I mean, it was all hands on deck. Anyone that could step up did, because we knew that, you know, she needed to be taken care of. We had no idea that in less than 2 weeks we were going to be in a lockdown. You know, and we had no idea if had she had gone, that would have been the end. We would have never seen her again, because there was no way that with her medical condition, she would have been able to survive that virus that hit all those nursing homes. So, you know, I'm very thankful that, you know, our family values are step up and take care of our families. With that being said, I am totally broke. I mean, I have to be realistic here. I have to work around my mother and everybody else's schedule in order for me to go and work to make ends.
And Erica, I mean, I'm looking at your name in Zoom. It says Emma Stumme. You have a master's in social work?
I do.
Right. So just to kind of pull out a few threads here, and because I want to get back to talking about the event, and I don't want to shortchange anybody's stories because these are so important, but, you know, we don't even have a $15 an hour minimum wage in Pennsylvania. You know, West Virginia has a higher minimum wage in Pennsylvania, and I don't like to throw other states under the bus, and I myself am from Tennessee, and I don't like the Pennsylvania thing, but I just want to point out that we have a lower minimum wage than West Virginia, and whatever you, I love West Virginia and people of West Virginia, but like, that's bonkers. And so, and I don't know, Lenoral, if somebody at SAU has done this math, but I'm guessing, because like, I know a fair bit about economics, if we paid home healthcare workers an actual living wage, which also means that all of the sort of add-on things like we talked about earlier, like when people could be in the community, like your roommate or people, you know, can go to work, that also generates more economic activity. And the multiplier effect and the taxation revenues from that would more than cover, right, some of the investment things we're talking about. So it's not an economic choice. Like this bullshit, sorry, that like we can't afford or people won't work is not there. And I take it as sort of like one of my personal quests to like shoot that down. These are political choices made by our political system about what are reasonable wages. And in fact, the economic benefit in terms of shared prosperity, I'm almost sure would be higher, right? Because going back to something Kearney said, how many home healthcare workers also get some form of government aid, like housing or food? Did you say half, 40%?
Half of home care workers rely on some form of government assistance.
So, you know, we're already as a society paying in terms of support for an indentured servitude class of workers. I mean, the indenture is not because you're forced to, it's because you all care too damn much, right? And you can't turn your backs on these people. That's what it seems like to me. Okay. All right. So $15 an hour minimum wage in Pennsylvania, all of the gender and sexism and patriarchy and racism pieces have like created the situation. I talked about political things, like it can change, right? So you're all here because you believe that. So Lenore, I don't know if you want to jump in, but there's this crescendo towards July 13th. You said there's a lot of other things going on. We've only got a few minutes. Like, what should we talk about July 13th? Or do you want to talk about other ways? Like, if I'm a home healthcare worker or another healthcare worker and I'm listening to this, let's do this first. Like, what should I do to be supportive?
So in addition to July 13th, we have been hosting town halls across the country with members of Congress. We are also asking people to call their member of Congress and ask them to support the investment in home care workers. And so the numbers that people can call, 877-689-2371. That's the English line, 877-689-2371. The Spanish line is 877-663-8727. 877-663-8727.
Okay.
Gentlemen, I'm gonna go. I saw you come off.
Yeah, yeah. Kid is ripping too. Yeah. Yeah. So, Maddie, si hablas español y quieres llamar al a tu representante en Congreso y pedir que apoyen the American Jobs Plan, el número, what was it, Lenore? 877?
El número?
Sí.
El número para llamar a su congresista en español sería 1-877-663-8727. 1-877-663-8727. Es muy importante que llamen a su congresista y por favor apoyar a toda esa gente y a las mujeres especialmente. Pero es muy importante que todo el mundo es esencial. Todo el mundo es esencial y esta epidemia ha sacado todo eso afuera.
¿Congresista, se dice?
Sí. Okay. Congressman.
Right. It sounds like little Congress or like general. Okay, but anyway, we can talk about Spanish.
Oh, it's in general, men or women.
Right. I think I heard Congressissimo and I was thinking something else. Okay, that's great. So, and then July 3rd. Okay, so that's what everyday people can do. Like if there were some, yeah, I think there's a lot of healthcare workers who are probably not part of SEIU, right?
Yes.
So is there, can they, should they reach out to SEIU? Like if I'm listening to this and I am, or I know one, this just popped into my head, but like.
So for other healthcare workers who would like to get involved, not only for July 13th, but overall with the campaign, they can go to www.careisessential.org. That's careisessential.org. Careisessential.org. For information on July 13th, we will be in action across 40 cities and 15 states. And so there's a map on that website where people can click and find locations where they can join in on the National Day of Action.
Yeah. And I love, cause I do a lot of organizing too. I love that you've got local things and Washington things, right? So like sort of different strokes for different folks. Can I say that? Kearney, Lynn, Erica, Maddie, Lenora, what do you know what your plans are on the 13th? Are you going to be here, there, in between?
I definitely am planning to join my union brothers and sisters on the van to DC.
The caravan?
Caravan to fight. To pass the Better Care, Better Jobs Act. And I know we are running short, but can I just spend just a little bit more time on explaining what that is for so that...
I have time. I was worried about y'all.
Oh, okay.
You can talk as long as you want.
Oh, okay. So I just want to just, in a nutshell, summarize what this is and what it means for caregivers across the country. So... The Better Care, Better Jobs plan will be a permanent fix to caregiver struggles. We've already talked about how care is essential. It's always been essential prior to COVID. We talked about how there's over 180,000 families who are waiting for care services, but families cannot receive the care that they need because of the poverty wages. This American Jobs Plan will bring 1 million union jobs to the economy. Caregiving, home care work is the second largest industry in Pennsylvania, and it's the fastest growing industry in the nation. So it is definitely infrastructure. So if we can get this passed, what this will do will stabilize our home care industry. And stabilizing the home care industry will raise our wages. We will get an increase in our salaries. So that will improve recruitment and retention because right now there's a high turnover. We don't have a uniform standard of pay, which we've already discussed statewide. So even though we've won the right to form a union, we don't have collective bargaining for essential improvements that we need on the job. This act will also allow us to invest in healthcare for our home care workers. We've been called essential workers, yet many of us can't afford to pay for ourselves if we get sick, if we have to have an operation. How are we going to pay it? Because we don't have health insurance and we can't afford it. So this act will help us invest to create a healthcare trust for home care workers so that we can begin to take care of ourselves and in our health needs. It will also contribute to recruiting, training, and connecting direct care workers. Right now, there isn't an official way to connect families and direct care workers to each other. So if something should happen to someone that a person is taking care of, then they're without a job or vice versa. So this will also contribute to the IT infrastructure if we are able to put in place a system where we can go look for job opportunities and vacancies. And so also with this training, which is very important, we don't receive a professional level of training. Our training is on the job as we go. When my grandmother had her first stroke, especially when she had her second stroke, and I did not want her to go into a nursing home, we brought her home. But I didn't know how to, I never had experience working a feeding tube. So my experience and my training came from on the job, Googling tube, you know, feeding tube, and watching YouTube videos. So every person that we care for has a different type of either disability or sickness that requires specific types of care. My mother was a cancer patient. One of my grandmothers was a stroke patient. My grandmother right now, who's 95, is on dialysis. My grandfather had a muscular degenerate disease. They each require different types of training and care, which we don't have the opportunity to get because there is no formalized training in the direct care worker model for training or to become certified. So,
hold on just a sec. So, it's because there's several pieces here. So you're talking about the standard of pay, the right to organize, I think the training piece that was about the excuse me. So those three things are all in the American Jobs Plan. Was there another one?
Those things are what we have requested that will be a part of that $400 billion to stabilize our industry.
Gotcha. And so you're going to Washington from Chester.
Yes.
On a care of. Okay. Lynn, where are you going to be?
So I'm also going to Washington, but because my consumer is coming along, we are going to be driving separately. I have a wheelchair accessible van. So we'll be driving down to DC. And
who picks the tunes?
that's a hot topic there. Mm. We have I think the last time we traveled, we went to Harrisburg for an event to lift up care work. And I actually listened to a podcast all the way about the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we'll see. Maybe
wow.
We'll get to control some music, but
you don't take a break. Okay. When I do podcasts, I sometimes go a little. Like I've recently discovered Scam Goddess. She's an actor, an African-American actor who's hilarious. And she does like different scams anyway. So nice. I say that because maybe someday I'll get a shout out from somebody else's podcast. Erica, where are you going to be?
I also am going to be heading to DC. Unfortunately, I can't do the caravan either because of my job. So I'll be driving down.
Maybe I missed that earlier.
Pittsburgh.
From Pittsburgh.
It only takes about 4 hours from here.
Yeah. All right. And Maddie?
I am from the hospital sector, and I am going to plan for my hospital members to do a digital recording as well to support all our brothers and sisters in the union, because if anything, this pandemic has brought how essential CNA work is to who make under $15 an hour, who have been burdened emotionally, physically, and financially with trying to just keep coming to work. And we are so short-staffed. This American jobs will probably, you know, enlighten people to really join healthcare and have more education. And I hope that it does, because it's essential. It's essential for the survival of the humanity, actually, for everyone to just be well.
Yeah, for sure. So Maddie,
I'm from the Poconos.
You're from the Poconos. Awesome. And also, I think something that, you know, people who maybe aren't as familiar with unions or with SEIU, you know, Lynn, Kearney, and Erica are all directly home care workers. You know, you're in the hospital. So what you're talking about is this kind of solidarity across sectors within SEIU. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, it has affected the hospital sector very much. So we didn't take a break. We were all hands on deck. You know, and the auxiliary workers in hospitals are not really thought of. But let me tell you something. When your housekeeper doesn't come in and there's a pandemic, you feel it. When your dietary worker doesn't come in and there's a pandemic, you feel it. So it was all hands on deck. Didn't matter what title you had, patients were our priority. And most of us became patients.
Yep.
Caring for our patients.
Oh,
and,
good point.
And we still kept coming. And trust me, we make about $12.50 an hour. So it wasn't the money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's important that our community thrives and we thrive.
Lenoral, I assume you're going to be in Washington.
Mm-hmm. I will be in Washington, but it's a hard choice because the actions are happening in L.A. and Oakland, Chicago, New York, D.C., and we also have an action in Atlanta. So It's a toss up, but I will likely end up in DC. But just want to say to any of your listeners, people who are interested in participating, go to www.careisessential.org and join us. Join in action across the country because we need as many voices as possible on July 13th.
That's fantastic. I kind of, if we can stay on for another minute, I just wanted to maybe circle back to something that I just think is really critical. And it's a little bit about this piece about America and values. You know, I mentioned my father's an immigrant. He's also was disabled. He lost both of his legs when he was 19 in a trolley accident in Barcelona. And so I feel like I've kind of seen like two sides of America, right? Like one reason he wanted to come and he was a physician. He was trained as a physician was because, and there were stories in my own Spanish family, you know, the expectation in Spain at that time, which was a fascist country, was that disabled people were to be hidden, right? He would never have been able to work. He was supposed to, there was actually, we still have a farmhouse kind of in the family that had been built for his aunt, who probably had epilepsy as best we can tell. And she was like hidden away. And so for him, America was this place where he could be, he could work, and there's a certain kind of freedom. And Lynn, I was thinking about life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness when you're talking about what you do with the Hoyt, the Hoyt, you know, lift is you're literally enabling that for your roommate and other healthcare workers. And then the other side, I think we're so bad at caring for the elderly, right? And I hope this comes across as sincere and not sort of weird, but like in the times I've been in nursing homes, I noticed how many people are immigrants, especially from Africa or the Caribbean, and they just seem to have an ethic of caring for their elders that, at least in a lot of parts of white America that I've been in, we've lost or we're sort of freaked out by bodies and death and fluids. And when my father was in hospice, you know, I emptied his, he had a urine bag. And I remember being like, you know, and as a child, it was like, you know, you gotta, I don't say man up, I don't mean it in that gender way, but you gotta step up and do that. And so I just feel like there's this big lie that a lot of America tells itself that like, all of the home care workers are doing all of that. That's very intimate and it's about body fluids and the body and often, you know, like dying or death, like in a hospice situation. And we don't want to see it and we don't want to pay for it, but there's this weird kind of two sides. Like we've been better than some places about the disabled. And I know we don't do enough, right. But I don't know if anybody has any sort of other reflections, but I just kind of wanted to lift that up. But I feel like at a really visceral level, we can talk about numbers. We can talk about pay. We can talk about all these things. But there's such a human element to this that I just don't want it to get lost, you know, in the policy talk. So I'll just step back.
I agree with you, Jordy, on that. I totally agree with you. Being a little bit older here, I do agree. And Latina, we value our elderly and we respect them. And I'm teaching my son that. I said, remember to respect your grandmother. Learn from her wisdom, because you just can't dismiss them. You know, the elderly have so much to offer, and they're so bright. And you're right, disability. My husband is now disabled and a bright man that has started two businesses. And you just can't dismiss him. He's still the head of the family. You know, he's still a strong man. His mind is still there. So don't dismiss anybody for their disabilities. Value everyone. Everybody has value.
And here's the thing. I mean, you know, we're not just talking about people who are disabled or elderly. No, because the harsh reality is that at some point in all of our lives, whether you make six figures or not, we will all come face to face with caregiving services, whether it is a temporary service due to a temporary sickness, accident, or injury, or if it's permanent due to a disability, aging family member, or someone with terminal illness. We will need someone to care for us. Let's not forget, some of us who might have broken an ankle or had surgery, we've had to have people come in our homes and help us get back on our feet. That is caregiving. You know, mm-hmm. someone has to pay for that. So we will all need someone to care for us, or we will need to find someone to care for somebody that we love, or we will have to care for a friend or a family. And I think that's also the most important piece. One of the important pieces here is that we can't act as if we're immune to this, because there are a lot of people who have gotten a harsh wake-up call, who have had to leave their careers, like many of us who have worked outside of the home and had careers, but we made this choice. We chose to keep our loved ones home, or the people that we care about home, versus going into a nursing home. So no one is immune to caregiving. People can, it can be out of touch, you know, out of sight, out of mind, if you've never had to deal with it at right now. But at some point, we will all come face to face with this decision, whether or not we keep someone home or we put them in a facility. And that is why we have to invest in long-term care and home and community-based services, because no one is immune to this. You know, many of us didn't wake up and say, oh, I want to be a caregiver. You know, many of us had other ideas and did other things. But when our family members or our friends, or because we just know someone who required that help, who needed that care, and with the conditions of nursing homes, we said, no, we are going to do this noble yet hard work and keep our loved ones home, because keeping our loved ones home and causes less hospitalizations. You get the direct care, our patients get the direct care that they require, and people who have worked many years of their lives, they don't have to sit around and wait for a shower or to go to the bathroom. So I just wanted to make that point, that it's not just elderly or those who are living with disabilities. It's you and I. It's, you know, our future. We will age at some point, and people don't like to associate the future with the present.
We have twins. My wife was, you know, bedridden, not that bedridden. That's not the right word. She couldn't get up for like 6 weeks to get anyway. So we had a home health care network of people who came, because we were both working. And so I was just thinking about what you were saying, you know, in that situation. And a lot of times that care comes with lasagna, which is always nice too. Okay. Any other last thoughts?
I just had one other thing to add to that, is that, like, our history, you're talking about, like, how we value our disabled people in this country, and our history, we don't have a good track record with that. We really don't. We had people locked away in facilities that were inhumane. They were terrible. And when my roommate was born, he was born in 1989. This was before the Americans with Disabilities Act. So he did not have the same rights that he does now. And we've come so far by providing home and community-based services to these people, to this community, to getting people out and active in the community. We have gained so much. We really have. But the system, right as it is, it's not sustainable. We have more people entering the community. We have short staffing in nursing homes, in hospitals, and in home care. And an investment in our care economy is just, it doesn't make sense not to. It improves the economy. It improves level of care for people. Everything that we say we value in this country, and, you know, there's just this focus on money all the time. Well, if it's just money, you're going to invest, because this creates jobs. You know, it creates, you know, the ability for care workers to contribute to the economy instead of having to rely on government assistance all the time. So it can't just be that. At some point you're going to say, you know, is this a partisan issue? Everybody needs care. I don't care who you are. If you're Republican, if you're Democrat, if you're independent, if you're whatever, I don't care. I'm still going to take care of you. But why is it that we see such a disparity sometimes in who cares about us? Right. Mm-hmm. Nobody cares about us until they need us. And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden you say we're essential. Well, if you think that we're essential, if you think that you need us, then prove it. Put your money where your mouth is. I can't eat your praise. You know, I can't pay for my bills with your accolades. I need actual money, you know, to contribute to the economy and continue doing what I'm doing. So I just think that it's important.
I think I just found the title for this episode. I can't eat your praise. So thank you for that. And that's a good one.
That's right. It takes a village.
Yeah, that's right. So this is going to kind of fade out and be sort of the end. There's a little bit of fun music that sort of overlaps with this. I mean, just want to, give a big, like, you know, heart and thumbs up to y'all and everything you're doing. It's really amazing. If you, like I said, I mean,